Welcome back to History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast. It's a bittersweet moment, as this will be the last regular episode of the special podcast series, The New Germany. However, I'm thrilled to have you tuning in once again. Joining our hosts Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody is expert guest Melanie Ammann. Please bear with us if the audio quality isn't perfect in some places. And now over to you, Katja and Oliver.
There now follows a party political broadcast brought to you by the Körber Stiftung, who may or may not endorse this content.
Hello, dear listeners. Are you concerned about the direction of German politics? Are you confused about the country's past? Are you wondering what the Zeitenwende really means for the here and now?
Well, we may not have all the answers, but if you elect to listen to this episode of our podcast, we'll give it a good try.
Welcome to The New Germany, the podcast for which apparently no pun is too laboured and no voice too silly.
I was rather pleased with that intro. And in any case, what we have to discuss today is no laughing matter. At The New Germany, we ask the serious questions, the ones that count. Like, has Germany really undergone a screeching U-turn since Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced the Zeitenwende over a year ago? What was the course the country was on in the first place? And where is it headed now? My name is Katja Heuer, and I'm a German-born, Brit-by-choice historian living in Sussex. And that election winner over there is Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin.
As you may have gathered from that coruscatingly whimsical introduction, this episode of our podcast will explore Germany's political parties. With the war in Ukraine asking new questions, do they have new answers? Will Germans vote differently after the Zeitenwende or fall back into old patterns? We will trace Germany's political parties back to their origins to explore how well they are equipped for the future.
Well, you know how they say all good parties happen in the 19th century?
Do you know what? I don't. Although I think there is a German expression about how the best parties always happen in the kitchen. Which I can say on the basis of 5 years of living in Berlin is categorically not true.
Well, that's no problem at all, because I like hanging out in the 19th century way better than in my kitchen in any case. So let's join the parties there, shall we? I'll bring the blue nun. But seriously, let's get us started, if you will, Oliver. How did political parties first come about in Germany, and what were they for?
Yeah, I mean, how do you define a party? Not you specifically, because I imagine that would involve a few bottles of Rotkäppchen fizz and some Prussia-themed charades. But
there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, we can debate this afterwards. But in general, when you get right down to the bottom of it, a political party is basically just a group of people working together in some kind of organisation to try and get things done through positions of public office. So before Germany is unified in 1871, the parliamentary constellations are pretty labile, but you essentially have four main agglomerations, if you like, or clusters. You've got number one, you've got the conservatives who want to keep the monarchy strong and society quite rigidly structured. Number two, you've got the liberals who want more of a rules-based system with a kind of constitution that would at least in theory objectively apply to everyone, including the monarch. Three, you've got essentially Christian activists trying to protect their country against creeping secularization and the appalling heresies of Charles Darwin. And fourth and last, you've got the various movements pushing the interests of the working classes with objectives ranging from fairly modest social reforms to implementing the dictatorship of the proletariat.
Well, if this all sounds a bit sort of far removed from where we're now, just bear with us for a moment. It really isn't. For one thing, these large groupings already fit fairly neatly onto a political spectrum, which we still use today. So this idea that you have right-wing and left-wing politics, with the right-wingers essentially being those who want to preserve things as they are, or as they were, and the left-wingers arguing for change or reform.
Do you ever find it a bit odd how we still use these terms from the French Revolution.
Not really. I mean, you know, the French do like a bit of political confrontation. So I think it's only fitting that they give us so much of our political vocabulary.
Yeah, so for those who've never looked into the origins of these terms, the members of the French National Assembly were physically split into those who supported the king and sat on the right, and those who favoured revolution who sat on the left of the chair. And as one member, the Baron de Gourville, put it, those who were loyal to religion and the king took up positions to the right of the chair, so as to avoid the shouts, oaths, and indecencies that enjoyed free rein in the opposing camp.
That sounds like something that Chancellor candidate Armin Laschet would have said in his 2021 campaign when he warned of a left-wing coalition.
That's a very niche joke, Katya.
Well, I would imagine we've got a pretty niche audience here, but I'm enjoying it anyway. Right, let's maybe leave revolutionary France behind and skip forward to a bit of what's going on once Germany is unified. Once Bismarck has set up a state, you sort of for the first time see an actual party political spectrum, because there are elections involving all male citizens, regardless of status and wealth, which is quite modern for the time. And this means that political parties are now putting out their stall basically to appeal to this rather large electorate. Interestingly, you get a fairly moderate outcome with that, which, you know, in terms of the offering that is available, there aren't many extremist kind of elements on the spectrum. You have kind of no outright communist party. The communists are still very much part of a wider left-wing coalition, or sort of clustered together under the same political party, the SPD, which we'll talk about a bit more in a minute. And then really the differentiation happens on the moderate right, where you got various different conservative parties as well as sort of liberals, which also still have a fairly sort of by definition national outlook, because they basically want a strong state to try and tie the monarch, the aristocracy and everyone too, which makes them slightly different from what we now understand, you know, under the term liberals. But basically you've got a pretty moderate spectrum. Nobody really wants to completely overthrow the system as it is. Everybody kind of wants reform one way or another rather than something completely different. But really, when you look at that, the new rising star amongst the political parties at the time was the SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Germany, which is arguably still the oldest political party in the country now.
And its origin story is liable to get a bit People's Front of Judea, Judean People's Front. If you go too far down the rabbit hole.
You're telling me off for niche jokes, are you? I mean,
well, it's 1-1 now. We'll get to 5-1 eventually. But to cut a very long story short, in the 1860s, a couple of big German workers' associations merge into a single party, the Sozialdemokratische Partei Deutschlands, in case anyone was ever wondering why the abbreviation is SPD rather than SDP. It's a very broad church, basically dominates the German left, sprawling from sort of incremental reformers all the way across to communists. Although in the end, Karl Marx turned on the party because he didn't think it was radical enough. And Bismarck and the German establishment do pretty much everything they can think of to keep the SPD at bay, going from banning it for 12 years to stealing some of its central policies, but ultimately the kind of historical forces behind it, this massive process of industrialization, urbanization, improving state education that Germany's going through, are just too strong to be contained. And so by 1912, the SPD is the biggest party in the Reichstag, but it's still locked out of government because the Chancellor and his ministers are personally appointed still by the Kaiser, who is, I think it's reasonable to say, not exactly a fan of social democracy. But then the First World War is a real turning point for Germany's party political landscape.
Yeah, it's interesting because it basically breaks up political parties into those who are happy to continue to support the war and the Kaiser and the monarchy, and those who think, no, we need to have peace now, it doesn't matter at what cost it comes. And also those who want to, with sort of Germany's war effort, also throw out its existing system. That's particularly strong on the left. So within the SPD, you see a split amongst those people, because that's really a kind of point of conscience for many people. Like, do you continue to fight or not? And as a result, you get a breakaway of the sort of hard left, if you will, the socialists and the communists within this kind of broad church of left-wing politics. And they begin to form separate parties. First, the so-called USPD, the independent SPD, and then the Communist Party, the KPD. And so for the first time, you end up with a political offering in Germany that includes extremist politics. As a result of that, because that happens on the left, the people on the right also feel like they need to counter that, and you end up with something called the Fatherland Party, effectively sponsored by the military dictatorship that Germany was under at the time, providing a counterpart on the right. And so I always feel that, you know, looking up Germany's party political landscape, the First World War is one of the big, big turning points, because you end up from kind of people arguing for reform to having really extreme poles at either end that are arguing for a completely separate system.
Mm. And that rift in the left really becomes one of the defining political fault lines of the Weimar Republic after the war, when you get the formation of a explicitly communist party, the KPD, and then it pretty much immediately tries to overthrow the SPD-led emergency government under Friedrich Ebert, and then the uprising is brutally crushed. And that division of the German left never really heals, despite all the persecution that both strands of it suffered under the Nazi regime. So after the Second World War, in East Germany, the two parties are forced into a kind of shotgun wedding, merged into the Socialist Unity Party, or SED, which is not renowned for its commitment to social democratic principles. And in the West, the KPD, the communists, were banned in 1956, which gave the SPD for a few decades a kind of artificial monopoly over left-wing politics. One piece of history that I think is really important here for the present, and has been kind of, I think, misremembered in a lot of ways, is the foreign policy of the first two post-war SPD chancellors, Willy Brandt and Helmut Schmidt, and specifically their Ostpolitik towards Russia, sorry, towards the Soviet Union, which is kind of remembered as being a kind of, almost a kind of unilateral form of detente, something that Germany was uniquely positioned to do, but was in fact predicated on a position of great military strength, certainly compared to the state of the German armed forces today. And also was very much in an Atlanticist framework, where Richard Nixon had been pursuing a form of detente with Moscow in parallel. Then after German reunification, this old split between the centre-left and the far-left comes back. The last shreds of the old East German ruling party join forces with a splinter group that breaks off from the SPD to form Die Linke, literally the left, which is very loosely speaking the heir to these various strands of leftist dissent we've been talking about.
Yeah, and when you look at the conservative side, I would also say that, you know, some of the kind of strands that you see before the Second World War continue as well, whilst others are broken up. So you could argue they were also unable, partially unwilling, to resist the Nazis as they came into power, and then also often suffered persecution as a result of this, as sort of Hitler's regime lashed out against anybody who vaguely disagreed with it. And especially the persecution of the churches under the Nazis kind of gave people some food for thought on the conservative end of the spectrum, and tried to sort of heal some of the divisions that were evident previously, particularly between the Protestants and the Catholics in Germany. So you end up not only with kind of a unification of thought, so the idea that there should only be one conservative party, so that is socially conservative, not necessarily in the same way that you'd understand it in an economic sense in Britain, but also with one that combines the various strands of Christianity into one. So rather having previously the centre party, or the Zentrum as the Catholic party, and then Protestant parties on the other side, you now have the CDU and the CSU sort of working in tandem as a coalition, kind of permanent coalition, if you will, permanent alliance of conservative thought in politics. Interestingly, a CDU also exists in East Germany, despite the SED, the Socialist Unity Party, having a monopoly really on political power. In theory, a multi-party state continues to exist, and the role of the CDU within that is quite interesting. The only time they opposed what the SED wanted to do was over abortion, where they felt very strongly that the kind of liberalization politics that were coming from the socialists were wrong and their kind of religious identity. And that's the only time they sort of, you know, kind of opposed this up until the end, when they become more outspoken towards the fall of the Berlin Wall. But they exist on both sides, and on both sides they make an effort to try and kind of combine both Catholics and Protestants in one Christian democratic union. I also thought it was quite interesting what Merkel then did to this party, which she headed from the early 2000s onwards, and then obviously led as chancellor for 16 years. I felt she pulled it very, very far into the centre, kind of away from its centre-right and quite small-c conservative politics, which made it, some would argue, fairly difficult to draw a line between them and the Social Democrats, which had also moved fairly far into the centre from the left. And then lastly, maybe we should mention sort of what happened to liberalism, although that is a question that is often posed. You had the Free Liberals, the FDP, emerge after the war as kind of a kingmaker. I would say that's the role that they mostly play on the political spectrum, sort of deciding who they form a coalition with, and therefore also putting pressure on the conservatives with whom they've traditionally worked with. But of course, at the moment, they're in a sort of left-leaning coalition together with the SPD and the Greens. So they do play an interesting role, sitting fairly sort of centrally within the political spectrum and adding their policies to whichever side they tend to go with.
And then the roster in the Bundestag today is completed by a couple of relative newcomers. And at least this time, you don't have to go back to the 19th century or the Second World War in order to... Sorry, Katja. In order to trace the origins of the German Green Party.
But you could. I mean, there's plenty of environmentalism going on in the 19th century. We could talk about, I don't know, the Flussverunreinigungsfrage or the Wandervogel movement of urban workers going into the countryside to enjoy nature.
As fascinating as all of that sounds, let's just take a very quick look at the modern-day Wandervögel and Lena Baerbock and Robert Habeck. The Green Party kind of coagulated out of this yogurty ferment of pacifist, hippie, anti-nuclear, ecological and feminist tendencies at the very end of the 1970s. And this is a period when environmentalism is not fashionable in Germany. And in fact, the SPD chancellor of the day, Helmut Schmidt, describes it as a fad for bored middle-class ladies. And if you dig out the pictures from the Green Party's founding meeting in Karlsruhe in 1980, it really looks like what Suella Braverman would call the sort of tofu-eating eco-rati. You've got all these knitted jumpers and batik dungarees and shaggy head students and greasy old 68ers. You've got Josef Beuys, the superstar modern artist. And then, of course, the face of the party, Petra Kelly, who used to turn up to all these demos in a soldier's helmet adorned with daisies as a symbol of her pacifism. And this is the milieu that a lot of the current generation of Green Party leaders grew up in. Annalena Baerbock, who's now the Green Foreign Minister, has talked about how her parents used to take her to exactly these rallies as a kid, which makes it kind of extraordinary how far the party has come over the 40 years since then. We've already talked about probably the biggest single jolt in the very first episode of our podcast about the German armed forces. Just to recap, it was at the end of the 1990s when the Greens got their first taste of serious political power in a coalition government, and their foreign minister, Joschka Fischer, had to persuade the party to sign up to Germany's first post-war combat missions in Kosovo. And then I would say the Greens went through another period of transformation after Baerbock and Habeck took over the leadership in 2018. There's a very deliberate effort to build links with big business, and the foreign policy thinking, at least at the top of the party, gets a lot tougher than it had been. And in fact, sort of forgotten now, but Robert Habeck actually suggested arming the Ukrainians in May 2021, so 9 months before the invasion, at a time when this kind of view was considered sort of absolute blasphemy across mainstream politics in Germany.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that hasn't really sunk in yet, with certainly not with the entire range of the mainstream media, who are still discussing when and if the Greens are moving away from their pacifist origins, when in fact they were well on their way, at least in some elements of the party, to do that even before the war in Ukraine. One last party we should mention, which has entered the political spectrum rather recently, is the AfD, or the Alternative für Deutschland, Alternative for Germany, which is very much not regarded as a fad of middle-class ladies, I would imagine, which sits sort of towards the far right end of the political spectrum, although it's made up of lots and lots of very bizarre figures, really, with lots of different political views. There's much infighting in the party, and there doesn't always seem to be a kind of unified message coming out of there. But the main thing that they've been able to thrive on and garner votes from is sort of fear, or the skepticism towards immigration. And this came on the back of the 2015 refugee crisis, when many voters felt that because it was seen as Angela Merkel's policy to open the doors to over 1 million refugees at the time, and this was coming from the Conservative Party under her, that there was very little room on the political spectrum to vote against such policies or to express skepticism towards them. And this was kind of part of the political spectrum that the AfD was able to sort of occupy or claim for itself. But we'll discuss that a bit further with our guest, who is an expert on these matters, in a moment.
And that gets you up to the eve of war in Ukraine. You've really got, at this point, a political spectrum with two mainstream parties, the so-called Volksparteien, or People's Parties, hanging around in the centre.
Yeah, you might say, or some might say, to the point of indistinguishability.
And then pretty much overlapping with them on a lot of policy issues, you have a kind of liberal, social democratic Green Party. And then to the left of that red, black, green blob, you've got the far left Die Linke. And on the right side of it all, you've got the light blue of the AfD. So, Katja, now that we've forced the listeners to eat their historical greens, what kind of lessons can we draw from all this, all about how the shock of the war in Ukraine is transforming the party landscape, in your opinion, and how these changes might unfold in the future?
Well, in an interesting way, I think there are actually, I mean, I would say that as a historian, but I think there are some references to the past here, in that war always forces people to think along different lines compared to peacetime. I mean, suddenly you get not Germany, obviously, as a war party, as was the case in the First World War. And so the feelings, I'd say, are maybe not quite as heated as they were then. But you begin to have another dimension on the spectrum, which is the war peace, you know, dimension. Where do parties stand on continuing with conflict or ending it, making concessions for one party or the other, siding with one party or the other? And I think this is something that all the political parties had to do, in light of the conflict with Russia, and of course, kind of whether or not and to what extent to help Ukraine. And this is a question that goes a little bit beyond what parties had basically used as their profiling, which is largely domestic politics. So it's just added another dimension, I think, for many people. Being, for instance, I don't know, conscious of the environment doesn't necessarily now have to come with either supporting Russia or Ukraine in the conflict, because that throws up an entirely different dimension of problems, I'd say.
This borders on a truism, but I really think it's worth stressing, because it tends to get a bit lost in the commentary on German politics these days, when we get hung up on whether Berlin is going to send this weapon or that one, or whether this faction or that faction in the SPD is dragging its feet. And I think we often fail to step back and look at just how far all four mainstream parties have moved towards more kind of classically Atlanticist, pro-NATO foreign policy and security policy positions, with relatively little internal resistance. And for me, the absolute sort of shining example of this is Rolf Mützenich, the leader of the SPD group in the Bundestag. And this guy is, you know, a lifelong inveterate pacifist of the old school, who literally wrote his PhD thesis about initiatives to keep atomic weapons out of Europe and called NATO's 2% target a dance around the golden calf. And now he's there whipping his MPs to vote for the biggest expansion of military spending in at least half a century, including an order of F-35 jets, just so that the US nuclear deterrent will remain credibly on German soil. And just the other day, he visited Kyiv and posed for these photos kind of squashed in between the Klitschko brothers. Just incredible scenes. And I don't think for a moment that Rolf Mützenich has kind of suddenly fallen off his horse on the way to Damascus and seen the light. The guy's a politician. And so I see him as a recalcitrant, sticky weather vane for the direction of German politics. And if so, if someone like Mützenich has been pushed around 90 or 180 degrees, just think how strong the prevailing winds must be.
I now have an image of Mützenich sort of flapping in the wind in my head, which is an interesting mental image. Yeah, I think it's certainly fair to say that the war in Ukraine has sort of thrown a spanner into the political works of Germany. And I'm very pleased to say that we have some help sorting this out and talking about it in perhaps a bit more specific terms. So we are delighted to welcome our guest.
I am very pleased to introduce our expert guest for today's episode, Melanie Amann.
Melanie is one of Germany's foremost political journalists. She's the co-editor-in-chief of Germany's leading weekly magazine, Der Spiegel, heading its Berlin office.
Melanie is ideally placed to discuss where Germany's political parties stand today and where they may be headed next. She has covered the CDU-CSU extensively and written a very well-received book on the AfD.
In her frequent media appearances in Germany and abroad, she speaks about these and many other aspects of German politics regularly. Melanie, welcome to the New Germany.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to our talk.
Since the last Bundestag election in 2021, Germany has been governed for the first time in many decades by a three-party coalition at federal level. Can we expect this to be the new norm in the years going ahead? And in what ways does it make the jobs of the Chancellor and the other people at the centre of government harder?
Well, I think you're right in pointing out that it's a very new form of a coalition, which might become the new normal, because we, in Germany, for decades, we've been used to seeing big and small political parties. There was the CDU, the Conservatives, and the SPD, the Social Democrats, who were taking turns leading the Chancellery. And then there were the smaller parties who were then the minority or the minor coalition partners and who helped the big parties gain a majority. And this system has slowly dissolved over the years. And right now, what we see is that the decline of the big, as we call them in German, Volksparteien, like the people's parties, so to say. And we've seen the rise of, for example, the Greens to, like, they are approaching the size of what was formerly only reserved for two parties, SPD and CDU. So this new coalition is a result of this, that in fact, the big parties cannot rule without, with just one partner. They have to forge an alliance with two partners, which are very, very different. Like looking at the Liberals and the Greens, they are on very different sides of the political spectrum, which leads me to your second question, which of course makes it way more difficult for the leading party to hold this alliance together, because there are frictions, there are disagreements, and it's not a marriage born out of love, but it's a calculation to gain power and to push through as much as you can as a political party. And of course, this leads to difficult conflicts and compromises.
And now I can't get the image of a marriage of love out of my head between Olaf Scholz and Christian Lindner. But moving swiftly back to the idea of the People's Parties, the Volksparteien that you just mentioned, they only received roughly a quarter of the votes each last time, which is why we now have this three-way coalition, whilst previously, you know, we had sort of figures of 30, sometimes even over 40%, which were quite normal for them to get in most years. Does the term Volksparteien still have any meaning?
I think it does, because it does not only concern the size of a political movement, but also the parts of society that are represented by them. And I think you can still say that especially the Social Democrats and the CDU come from, their electorate is based in very different parts and layers of society. And so the word People's Party refers to the fact that a political party has a strong base, not just in one small community in Germany, but has a very diverse electorate, let's put it that way. And I think this is still the case both for CDU and for SPD, even though the numbers, like the absolute numbers, are dwindling.
And if we're saying that people are sort of spread out further across the political spectrum and they're moving towards some of the smaller parties more than they have before, does this mean that there's a healthy range of political parties available to voters, or is there something missing on the political spectrum?
I think this has always been a strength in the German system and of our electoral law, which has many flaws, but it certainly enables different political movements to gain momentum and for a lot of political opinions to be represented in our parliament. I think this still works. Yes, you have the Greens, you have the Liberals, you have the left-wing party, the Conservatives, you even have a right-wing party now, which one can mourn because it's a populist, partly extremist movement, but it's still a chance for most political opinions to find some kind of representation.
I'd like to come back to the right-wing populist question in a minute, but I've lost track of the number of polls I've seen in Germany in recent years where the most popular option has been keiner davon, none of the above. And it's clear that there is a large proportion of the electorate that is turned off by mainstream political parties and that has a relatively low level of trust in these parties. This is a very big question, but what do you think are the main sources of that disenchantment, and what kind of things could be done about it?
I think it has grown over the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years. One factor was the first, maybe the euro crisis, the build up of many crises in a row, the financial crisis, the banking crisis, the euro crisis, then the refugee crisis, and most recently, of course, the war in Ukraine and the way it has been dealt with by the chancellery. And there was always a part of the German population that was unhappy with the solution presented, and especially during the years of the Merkel's grand coalition during the refugee crisis, there was no real opposition in the Bundestag, in the parliament, that would voice the concern that maybe the number of refugees coming to Germany might be too many and that something had to be done to limit it. And this worry was not just uttered by radicals, but also by moderate voters. And I think there was at one point maybe a breach of trust and confidence in the ability of the parties represented in parliament to solve the problems we're faced with. So this is a sentiment that has been building up for quite some time.
And staying with the AfD for a minute, you put forward a sort of slightly punning alternative name for the party in your book about them in 2017, Angst für Deutschland, a sort of angst or fear for Germany. The argument being that the party is pandering to and building on the existential fears of its voters. Can you explain a little bit more how that works? And you've already talked about how they sort of gave a very visible, audible voice to voters' concerns about immigration. But what role does the party play in the political landscape of Germany more broadly?
Well, my take on the AfD back then, but I think it still holds up today mostly, maybe even more than back then, was that there are three or four main ideological sources the party stems from. And one is using the sentiment of fear, worry of the political situation and the future, be it your personal future, but like maybe a part of the population fearing it might lose its wealth and personal security, feeling threatened by globalization, feeling threatened by the danger of mass immigration and the loss of wealth during the euro crisis. So these fears, which are very primal in a way and substantial and not necessarily irrational, quite understandable, in fact. But the AfD has been exploiting this fear, or has been working directly addressing, tapping into this fear to use it politically in a way that is actually, from the communication point of view, very new to my country, to my country's political communication, which has before been more sensible or more cooler in a way.
And because of that, many people have argued that the party needs to be at the very least monitored, if not perhaps even restricted or outright banned. These debates have been going around for quite some time, actually, in Germany. To what extent, you know, does the party political spectrum need protecting by sort of banning extremist parties and anti-constitutional parties, as has happened, for example, with the Communist Party in the post-war years? Are these, in your way, viable ways of protecting democracy, or is it actually a threat to it by taking the sort of options away from voters that want them there?
Well, the idea to have our internal security services monitor AfD does not come from the fact that they're exploiting fears, but it comes from the fact that they're actually actively disseminating racism and anti-democratic thought. So this is yet another level of threat to our democracy than simply a populist way of communicating and exploiting fear. I think this is something that you might see, like, in a way more modest version from other parties, but this, like, the fact that they are being deemed extremists is because they are using xenophobic points of view and are directly agitating against foreigners and minorities. So this, just to put it ahead, but I don't think that watching the AfD by the security services is an effective way of dealing with them. It's necessary. I mean, it has to be done. It's in order to protect our constitutional system. But it certainly isn't a way to fight off the populist threat. I think the populist threat is still very present and very aggressive, even with the security services monitoring the AfD. And they've actually been using it to victimize themselves. And I think for, like, a healthy political system, we would have to find a response to this threat, which is on a political level and not necessarily on a constitutional security services level.
The full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine last year seems to have really shaken up the kind of foreign policy agenda of most of the big parties in Germany. And I'd like to ask about two in particular. First of all, the Social Democrats or the SPD have really had to revise a lot of the ways that they thought foreign and security policy works. And also the Greens appear to have been kind of accelerated on this journey they were already on, from being a kind of pacifist party back in the 1980s to something much more kind of obviously transatlantic. So how deep and how lasting do you think these changes are going to be? And are we seeing the Zeitenwende filtering through into Germany's party political landscape, in your opinion?
I think the change is profound, and I think it's a major turning point for the whole political debate in Germany, and not only for the Greens. We have a change in perception of, like, Germany's role in the world, our whole security policy, and the question how much responsibility we can and want to take, like, both in a military way and in a political way. And we are only at the beginning of this debate yet. I mean, I was surprised by how swiftly the Greens have adapted to this new reality. Like, just looking at the political party, I was surprised by how little resistance there was within the party against suddenly the decision to deliver weapons and to fund the army massively. And on the other hand, in the German society, the urge, like the whole peace movement, has been almost invisible since the beginning of the war last year. And I feel that only now the peace movement is slowly regrouping, like maybe urged on by figures like Sarah Wagenknecht, a left-wing politician who just started a petition to enter peace talks and stop weapons delivery to Ukraine, which almost 700,000 people have signed. So I believe that the whole social debate will culminate much more in the next months, and that during the first year after the invasion, the German society was kind of pulling along and the Green Party was pulling along. But now it's like a slow awakening to the reality, and the doubt is beginning to seep in into the Green movement and all the parts of society which are very prone to a peace position. They, I think, they are getting more active, they're organizing themselves better.
When I was covering the 2021 election campaign, it was really striking how seldom foreign policy came up at all in the leading politicians' speeches, in the debates, even in the kind of press coverage of what was in the manifestos and so forth. And when you talk to politicians about this, they just, that wonderful German phrase about how you can't win a flower pot with that subject. And even now today, when you talk to politicians in the CDU-CSU about what they regard as their very principled stand in terms of urging the Scholz government to do more on Ukraine, they will say that they don't regard this as a kind of electorally winning strategy. Do you see this ever changing? Can foreign policy, or is foreign policy becoming politicized to the point where it could conceivably change the outcome of elections in Germany?
Yes, I absolutely do think so. I think there's a renaissance of foreign policy in Germany and circles of the German society which have not really been interested in foreign policy are way more open to it, and it's playing a much bigger role in the political debate. And I think Germany used to have, like the German debate used to have a very national focus, a very clear focus on domestic issues, on our little, like our small micro conflicts within the government about maybe social reforms or justice system reforms, but like the broader outlook and outside of the European Union too. Like this has really been changed by the war of Russia against Ukraine.
Well, sadly, that's all we have time for today. Melanie, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us and our listeners.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And if our listeners would like to read more of Melanie's work, those who know German can find her book Angst für Deutschland in all good German bookshops. And her articles appear regularly in Der Spiegel and on its website. And some of them are translated into English. And you can find her on Twitter.
Thank you so much.
At Mel Aman, with two N's at the end.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed yourself at our political party. There were no drinks, no prawn cocktails, but plenty of three-letter organizations and German compound words. What's not to like?
Well, how about you give us one last party piece, Catcher? How about you tell us your best political joke?
All right, since you asked. Why should it have been obvious that communism was doomed to fail?
I don't know. Why should it have been obvious?
All the red flags were there.
All right, we're gonna quit while we're ahead and end this podcast on an intellectual high. If you have better jokes than Katya,
or a lower comedy threshold than Oliver,
then do let us know. We're both on Twitter, or you can direct your thoughts straight at the Körberstiftung, who will be delighted to receive them.
Farewell from Sussex.
And bis zum nächsten Mal aus Berlin. Tschüss.